Thursday on Folk Radio.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
And listen to the music in the air.
Sound like the world was coming to an end. Somebody had passed and dropped a bomb.
Tune in Folk Radio Thursday from 10 p.m. to midnight on WBAI and WBAI.org.
She treated me nice and I'd like to find her again. But old Eden Denver, I just can't remember her name.
All right. Excuse me. the previous program was Left on Left. I apologize. I think I mentioned in the beginning of the last hour calling it Laughing Out Loud because it had the initials LOL, but it is Left on Left, and it's hosted by Craig Jardula and Jeremy Karasmasov. And that is heard 4:30 p.m. on Wednesdays here on WBAI New York. It is now 1 minute past 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz coming up.
Place. We're living in times where men commit crimes and crime don't have a face. We live in a political world, icicles hanging down, wedding bells ringing, angels singing, clouds cover up the ground.
Good afternoon. This is Arthur Schwartz on Advocating for Justice on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This, as usual, I have to begin this show by pitching. I'm sure that you've been hearing pitches all day, but we cannot stay on the air. We are in the most existential of existential crises at WBAI, needing to raise, you know, into the six figures in order to pay the various bills that we need in order to continue functioning as a radio station as we have back to 1960. I think that's right, Reggie, right? 1960. And so please go to WBI.org. Just think about, you know, in recent days, you've heard more news about, for those of you who follow it, the campus situations, whether it's at Columbia or NYU or other places. In my youth, I used to listen to WBAI to get news of the latest doings at anti-war demonstrations and find out about, even listen to national demonstrations. I couldn't monitor anywhere else because WBAI was available. And this radio station is an invaluable tool for progressive thinking people in the New York metropolitan area and beyond that. Since when we started, we were a radio station. Now it's WBAI.org. So please go to WBAI.org, become a WBAI buddy, even if it's just $10 a month. $10 a month, $120 a year will pay for half of this show. So maybe you can make it $20 a month, you'll pay for the full cost of airing just this one show. Our first guest today, or only guest today, is Bruno Gransard. Are you with us, Bruno?
I am.
So Bruno was on the show probably back in February, is my recollection, when he was contemplating running for Congress. And in the 10th Congressional District, for those of you who don't know, the 10th Congressional District is probably the most liberal district in the United States, at least in my opinion, the most left-leaning. Maybe Berkeley is more, because it's a district that was created just 2 years ago that includes Greenwich Village, like east, west, central, all the way from the Hudson River to the East River, all of Lower Manhattan, Soho, Fidei, Chinatown, and then goes over the Brooklyn Bridge and goes over to Brooklyn Heights and parts of Park Slope. So you can't get a more liberal, so a more white constituency anywhere in a big city in the United States. And 2 years ago, we had an election. We had a primary because it was an open seat. There was no congressperson that wanted to run in that district who lived in that district. And we had 10 candidates, and the one who won was a guy named Dan Goldman, who won by 1,600 votes after spending about $7 million. And he beat another candidate who came in second, named Yulee Niu, by about 1,600 votes, maybe 1% of the vote in the primary. And then that was it, right? There's no Republicans run in our district. I happen to live in that district. So Bruno came along, and he decided to run. And before I ask him about it, I'm going to play a clip that he of his little announcement on Instagram of what he did over the period between the beginning of March and the beginning of April.
I have great news. Petitioning is over. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of fun, and it is now over. I expect to be on the ballot. I'm also very pleased to report that my first 3 months are fully in line with my commitment to run a true grassroots campaign. I've walked 250 miles. I have collected, together with some great volunteers, 2,510 signatures without relying on an external service. The campaign has spent only $3,000 to date, all of which was raised from small contributions from great people like you. Thank you so much. And I've done a lot of listening. I've done a lot of learning and had great conversations with so many voters. I'm really looking forward to this next phase of the campaign. Thank you so much for your support.
So welcome, Bruno. So here we are. Thank you. We spoke in the beginning before you started petitioning, and now you've spent a number of months out on the street. Tell us about your method of getting on the ballot. How did you get all those signatures?
Well, before getting on this, you know, actually petitioning, because I believe that running for election should not be about how much money you have, how much money you're willing to spend, how much time you're willing to spend raising money. It should be about your character. It should be about your ability to interact with constituents and your ability to solve problems, you know, come up with creative solutions. And so I started out in mid-January after I had filed with the FEC, walking every street of the district. That was sort of my commitment. I want to see and hear from people. Let's do that sort of the good old-fashioned, the bad old-fashioned, the good old-fashioned political methods of just talking to people in a very grassroots fashion. So I started on Bay Ridge mid-January, and I decided, you know, I'm going to walk every day, 5-10 miles. You know, you can't walk for 20 miles because you're talking to people. I was talking to people, giving flyers out, and really listening, just absorbing the information, learning, you know, the differences in opinions between, you know, between neighborhoods, communities, having a blast in the process. And, you know, that lasted until petitioning started in early March. But I had already had a fair amount of exposure to voters, you know, just by walking every single street. And at that point, I wasn't done, but I had walked at least 250 miles at that point. Now, the actual petitioning process, I didn't really know what to expect. And I like to do things on my own first. Let's see, try it out before you start, you know, really actively hiring volunteers or trying to get people to help. And I said, let's just go on the street and try different areas. And, you know, my first evening of trying was an absolute disaster. But soon after, I figured out what are the hot spots, the places where you're going to get people to be willing to spend time with you, because you're asking them to sign a document, basically. And I found that people essentially, they love their kids, they love their dogs, they love their gods, and they love their booze. So those are the places where you find them willing to spend a little time and discuss, you know, politics and sign a petition. So, pretty much 2 weeks into it, I knew I'd have my, you need 1,250 valid signatures. So that means registered Democrats in your district. Most, a lot of people don't really know what district they live in. And, you know, it's a challenge to fine tune that. So you really have to overshoot by a factor of at least two. So I my target was 2,500 and I reached that. I had some volunteers, friends and family helped out. Some, you know, perfect strangers as well, but I did probably 85% on my own in the process, having some great discussions, really understanding what are the hot buttons, the things that really matter to people, and enjoying myself actually in the process.
So you basically want, you said from Bay Ridge, does the district go all the way that far?
The district starts at 69th Street in Bay Ridge. Okay. You know, Bay Ridge is, it's only three or four streets in Bay Ridge. Bay Ridge, okay. The definition, I think, is 65th maybe. So, but that's where it started.
So walking from Bay Ridge all the way to 14th Street in Manhattan. Across
town. Exactly. Exactly. It wasn't a straight line like that. I mean, it really depended on the weather and so on.
So what did you discover? Well, let me ask you, for number one, did anyone know who their congressperson was?
I'd say in the hyper politicized neighborhoods, like the one I live, Park Slope, in the Village, probably 30-40%, maybe.
They knew who their congressperson was.
The district was, you know, so the district was created in 2022, and, you know, so a lot of people thought they were still in the district of the prior congressperson. They're still getting the emails from that prior congressperson. So I'd say, and then in other less politicized neighborhoods, less than a quarter, I would say. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, this is not scientific polling, just based on my conversation.
I get it. What was their impression that we were picking up much of a,
I would say, so a lot of people, those who didn't know amongst people who knew, you have pretty much four categories. One are people who really admire Dan Goldman for, his work, in the impeachment. So people who tend to be really obsessed with Donald Trump, they have a favorable opinion. People who are extremely staunch supporters of Israel had a favorable opinion. On the other side, you have a big chunk of voters who were upset at the fact that there were so many candidates, no ranked choice voting in primaries, and Dan spent $7 million, you know, 12 times what Yulin spent. So, you know, just feeling that that's really shouldn't be the way it works. And then people who are super upset at U.S. support for Israel. And, you know, those are the two categories that really don't like him or really dislike him intensely versus those who like him or really like him.
And all right. So what did you find? What issues were people most, because in walking around, I guess you're the talkative type. So what issues did you find that people were most concerned about?
So I put together a little flyer with sort of my top three ideas that I was giving out, but really with my intent not to sell those ideas, really just to listen. But you have to give something about yourself and what you believe in. And those were, you know, climate change, which is a field I work in. It's political reform. Basically, open primaries with ranked choice voting to address the partisanship. And thirdly, just general affordability issues. And I've worked, I'm a trained economist, worked for many companies in different capacities, you know, helping startups in climate mostly now. And so I have a pretty good feel for those type of issues. But what I did is, again, I would ask them, well, what are your key issues? You know, in the neighborhood, nationally. And so, I mean, the biggest issue that came up, and I made changes to my flyer, obviously, e-bikes were the biggest number one issue that came, the first answer. And that honestly surprised me. The dangers of commercial e-bikes, which hurt people. I met during the walk, and I'd say I interacted with probably 5,000 or 6,000 people, but had real conversations with about 2,000. Three people had gotten hit by e-bikes, and I met an pediatric ER doctor who pleaded with me to do something because he kept on getting kids that are getting hit by e-bikes. So that surprised me. I didn't expect that to be number one. It's not a small issue, but not a national issue, a local issue.
And what about nationally?
So in terms of national issues, the three big issues were sort of in line with my preconceived idea. One is clearly, and it is a local issue, but it has national implications. I mean, affordability, difficulty of living in this city, the cost of living, people making $200,000 who feel poor, feeling that, we can't afford, to raise our kids in the city, people making a lot less, just worried about losing their homes or not being able to pay rent. So housing and affordability were by far the biggest issue. I mean, there's no doubt. Second, and climate change was top three for almost everyone outside of some communities or some communities that are just, they're not into it for whatever reason. But I would say 80% of the neighborhoods and communities I went to, climate change was clearly one of the top three issues. And the third one, probably much, lower down the rank, but still an important issue is democracy, Donald Trump, partisanship, the dysfunction of Congress, just all these issues that we can't really seem to get anything done. I think those were so that was not a huge surprise, I guess, those three issues. What were surprising is that every single neighborhood had different issues and, the intensity of dislike of parking, restaurant sheds in the village. I mean, like that was huge, or the intense unhappiness with traffic on Grand Street in the Lower East Side, or the fear that people were, that parks are getting encroached on, or the absolute fury of people on the East Side over the East River Park and how, under the guise of climate resiliency, which I'm a huge proponent of, a mess was made out of the East River Park, destroyed, spending a couple of $1 billion and no real long-term solution since, it won't even protect from higher water levels in 50 years. So very, very specific issues in each neighborhood.
So how did the Middle East play in? How did the situation in the Middle East play in the ranking there? It doesn't sound like it came up a lot.
Well, no, it did. It was a minority of voters, but who felt very intensely. So I felt it more than any other issue, but it was not it depended again on the neighborhood. Some neighborhood, not a single, if I think of Sunset Park or, downtown Brooklyn, I mean, didn't come up at all. Or Chinatown, zero, right? But in some other neighborhoods, I'd say maybe one in, I'd say it's 5 to 15% of the folks, but having, it's probably a little more. I'm thinking of those who are very much in favor of Palestinians and Hamas and ceasefire type thing. So maybe 5 to 15% on that side, maybe 5 to 10% on the Israeli side who were very vocal about it. So maybe a quarter of voters in specific neighborhoods were very intense. And I discovered that very soon one issue I got insulted on where, I'd be asked, what's your position on this? I said, well, it's a little more nuanced, can we hear me out? Let's discuss it. And I get the, F you kind of thing, which it was pretty clear that until I was going to be on the ballot, it was not an issue I was going to focus on, because it's just too emotional for most people. And honestly, there weren't discussion. It was just, you know, you agree or you agree with me and you're with me or you know, I hate you.
And it's a problem that exists probably on both sides of the argument, and that people don't listen to other people and don't see the nuances of it. In my opinion, it makes me a minority on this radio station. What's your program? How do you focus? Because I think of you as a climate change person, right? So just for people who didn't hear you before, you have a background in dealing with climate issues. What do you do in that respect?
Sure, absolutely. So, first of all, I was an environmentalist my whole life. I was raised in a tiny little rural village in France, you know, outside of Paris. It's a longer story. I won't go into it, but you know, it got me exposed to nature very early on in life. And my parents would take us camping all summer because my father was a professor. When I graduated from university and grad school and so on, I started helping companies figure out their global strategies. I had lived in Europe, studied in Japan, and you know, I had a pretty good global perspective. So basically my job is to solve problems. And that's sort of been my career, try to analyze situations, solve problems. I had an incubator that I created in Japan for little startups, and I like working with small companies. But once I did that was sort of in my youth. When I had kids, I started working for larger companies, and my job was to analyze companies and industries that are at the center of climate change. Climate change was not necessarily central. That wasn't why I was necessarily asked to do that, but I got to really get excellent insights as to why people are buying these types of cars that are polluting. Why are hybrid cars, did it take, you know, so long for them to sell more of them? Why did the EVs take so long to develop? Why do industrial companies not invest in energy efficient tools? So I really got a very good grasp for all these issues by covering autos, industrials, utilities, renewables, real estate, and other sectors. And you know, my passion has been climate the whole time. I started then helping figure out how do you create ESG, how do you incorporate ESG into, you know, investment philosophy, for example. But ultimately, 3 years ago, I said, okay, I'd rather just go and work directly for startups. And so I started a consultancy where I help startups that have products and solutions that are useful for climate, and I help them scale up. That's my core competencies. You know, take something small and figure out how do you grow faster. You know, so I could be a fraction CFO. So it means a part-time CFO for a company. I could be a co-CEO to help launch it. I could just help them do their deals globally. That's what I do. And, you know, throughout that, with that know-how, I've sort of really developed a set of very clear ideas as to how to tap private markets and entrepreneurs to help this transition, using the force of the government and the influence.
So what is your feeling about how committed the United States government has been to dealing with climate change, and what do you see as the role it should be playing in the future?
So until now, there's been no commitment. I mean, partially just because, you know, we've had Republican, when this became fairly big, it was under Clinton, you know, the election Al Gore would have probably changed a lot, but then we had Bush, then we only, you know, Obama tried, he did some things, but he was blocked. And so, did not get that much done. Then we had Trump, but under Biden, I must say, I'm really impressed with the Inflation Reduction Act. I know it's named Inflation Reduction, which is not really relevant to this. I mean, it's a stretch. You can make it relevant, but the key point is that bill is an outstanding first attempt at tackling climate change in the U.S. economy. But what it does, it's tackling climate change through subsidies to industries and people, like, you know, a tax credit when you buy an EV, and a lot of money to industry to do that, right? So, but but it only targets the bulk of the industries that are affected are autos and power producers, so energy, you know, electricity production. And that is about, you know, just under 40% of our emissions. That's not enough. We left out 60%, which is agriculture, industry, real estate, heavy transport, and more. And that's what we need. We need to have an Inflation Reduction Act 2 with similar type programs. And then there's a lot more. I'm happy to go into it.
Can you talk about, I read an article recently that whether it was the world or the U.S., that the production of carbon had leveled off, like it didn't rise this year. How is the U.S.'s contribution to that whole global gas going?
Yeah, I mean, U.S. Carbon emissions have been declining for about 15 years. So we're in the right direction slowly, but it's very slow decline. And certainly at the global level, that hasn't been the case. So Europe, basically developed country emissions have been declining, but they've been more than offset by China and emerging markets.
And if you were in Congress, what would you do? How would you make it better?
So how would I make it better? So one is I take in the Inflation Reduction Act, one, and I'd extend it to industry, I'd extend it to agriculture, and I'd extend it to real estate and heavy transport. Same type of subsidies, just to encourage companies, you know, to reduce the hurdle to making those investments. Okay. It also, you know, so if you just think about like New York City, we have Local Line 97, which calls for the reduction of emissions from our buildings. It's going to be tough to get small, house, apartment building owners to make these investments without some kind of assistance. It's a great law. I really like it, but you know, for it to happen faster and in a more less painful way, we should provide financial assistance. The second thing we need to do is there are a number of, there are many levers that the government has. And one of those levers is the tax code. So I talked about the subsidies, but the tax code. So we give a lot of subsidies, indirect subsidies or tax breaks, to a lot of folks, a lot of industries, without asking for anything in exchange. Let me give you an example. Agriculture. I know this is super wonky and not what something, you know, not typically spoken of in New York City.
It's all right to be super wonky, because most people we see in Congress are the other end of the equation.
So think of ethanol, the production of ethanol that, you know, anyone who has a car or rented a car knows that, you know, it's about 10% of the mix of gasoline. It's a total waste of energy, by the way, and you know, but I won't go into that. It's a reality. A big chunk of our corn, and I'm going to go from memory, maybe 40%, but don't quote me on that, of corn produced is used in ethanol. But there's no standards as to how that corn should be produced. So you can use as many pesticides as you want, pollute as much as you want. The government's still going to let you use that ethanol in the blend, put it to gasoline. And that doesn't make any sense. You know, we have this phenomenal lever. It is profitable for these farmers to produce this corn to be used in ethanol. It's profitable for the ethanol producers to transform that corn. Why don't we have minimal standards of how that corn should be produced? Let me give you another example. Again, it's in farming, but it really affects the cities. The farm bill includes a lot of money for school lunches. But I mean, anyone who has sent their kids to school recently, you know, the school lunch is really an insult to nutrition, to health, to agriculture. I mean, it's great that we're providing free meals for some kids. I certainly support that. But for $20 billion, roughly, we could double that and mandate that where, first of all, it should be more nutritious food, and where possible, it should be, you know, should be produced in certain ways. Again, I don't want to say fully organic, because it's not always possible, right? But that's another example. Farm insurance, Okay, I'll stop talking about farming. Let me talk about another one, real estate. So when you buy a building, when someone builds a building or a company builds a building and rents it out, the company can depreciate the value of that building over 27 and a half years, I believe. And we need more buildings. You can't push for housing and remove that. That's a good law because we need more construction right now because there's no other way to deal with the housing crisis. But when you get Blackstone that buys up portfolios of properties across New York and elsewhere, and then can take the value of their investment and depreciate that over 27 and a half years, you know, reducing that affects their cash flow. So their profits, declared profits, and reduces their taxes. What benefit do we get as a society? You know, for small owners, that's great. We need to encourage that. But for a large company, it makes no sense. So fine, you want to have that depreciation break. You're going to have to invest in energy efficiency. Your buildings need to be up to X code. I don't want to give numbers because this is super technical and, you know, you need to have a bunch of smart people around the table figuring that out. But directionally, that's what we should be doing. Same with, you know, industry. I mean, there's so many tax breaks where we're not leveraging the power of the government for good. So that's another example.
We're going to take, I get to be a disc jockey like three times a show, but I always start with the song, so twice. Just in honor of your walk, which I think you said you've walked 250 miles.
I'm at 350 now, 350.
350. So I found a song, which is a big Scott hit in Scotland, or at least it was 10 years ago, called Walking 500 Miles.
To Scotland. When I wake up, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who gets on next to you. And if I give up, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who steve next to you. I'm gonna be the man who's working hard for you. And when the money comes in for the work I do, I'll pass almost every penny on to you. When I come home, I know I'm gonna be the man who come back home for you. And if I go, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who's going home.
This is Arthur Schwartz on Advocating for Justice on WBAI 99.5 FM. We were just listening to the Proclaimers. This was a big Scottish hit around 2006 called I'm Going to Walk 500 Miles, which I played in honor of Bruno Grantzart, who's our guest this afternoon. Please, everyone who's listening to this show, you want to hear more people like Bruno. You want to hear people who are going to talk about, you know, climate change and inequality in society and talk about it intellectually, not just sloganeering. We need a radio station like WBAI. And in order to keep us on the air, we need your money. So please go to WBAI.org, become a WBAI buddy. If you're listening on the air, go when you get home. If you're listening while you're doing the show, you can actually keep listening and go and make the contribution at the same time off the website. So we've been interviewing Bruno Grant-Sard, who is running for Congress in the 10th Congressional District, which stretches from, now I know it stretches all the way from 14th Street in Manhattan throughout Lower Manhattan to Sunset Park in Bay Ridge. It includes Brooklyn Heights and in Park Slope. So I want to switch a little bit here because one area that I think Dan Goldman has differed from other Democrats and lined up with Republicans. And the Republicans have all of a sudden become the great defenders against anti-Semitism, which somewhat makes me nauseous to them to make that claim, since their big hero didn't have any problem calling people chanting "the Jews shall not replace us" back in Charlottesville back in 2017, fine people. One place he has differed is that he has joined with Republicans in both in moving to censure Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman, and also in voting in favor of a resolution that said anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. I'm going to play two clips, one from Ilhan Omar talking about her view on this question, and then from Jerry Nadler, and then I'm going to ask you for your impression. Reggie, if we can go to Ilhan first.
Something happened again at a forum in D.C. where you said, quote, "I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country," end quote. That was also criticized as playing into stereotypes about divided loyalties about Jewish people. Mm. You did not apologize mm-hmm. for that. Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain?
Yeah, I was not talking about Jewish people. And that, for me, is why I did not apologize. What I was talking about was myself. And the pressure that I was feeling towards me to take a certain political stance, and for people to say, you know, if you do not take that particular political stance, then you're not American enough, you're not a patriot. I will make, you could go through any of my social media posts, people will like respond with an Israeli flag, and oftentimes like I don't know what this response is really supposed to mean. And so for me, it was going through a process of explaining, right, that I myself took an oath as I got sworn in to serve the constituents of the Fifth and the American people. And that is really the only qualification and the only requirements I place on myself.
This is a blunt question and the last one on this topic. Mm-hmm. Are you anti-Semitic?
Around the world, absolutely. On college campuses and online, is so shocking that it was the subject of nearly every Jewish household's Thanksgiving meal a week ago. The Jewish community is absolutely right to consider this terrifying situation a five-alarm fire, as Senator Schumer so appropriately put it in his moving speech to the nation just a few days ago. Unfortunately, this resolution does absolutely nothing to genuinely counter the scourge of anti-Semitism, nor does it help bring us together with the unity of purpose that this topic merits. Rather, it is another attempt in a long series of veiled efforts by the GOP to weaponize Jewish lives for political gains. It is another partisan gotcha game that amounts to cheap value signaling, not serious action. But if there ever was a time for real action, it is now. Today, in the face of the largest increase in anti-Semitism, both violent and virulent, in this nation's history, we have a clear choice. We can abuse this moment to try to inflict inter-party political damage, or we can rise to the occasion and do something real and powerful to actually help the Jewish community. Just in the last few weeks, we have seen disgusting displays of outright anti-Semitism. Over the weekend, protesters in Philadelphia targeted a Jewish business. It is plainly and unequivocally anti-Semitic to hold Jews collectively responsible for Israel's actions. In my district, vile anti-Semitic graffiti has been scrawled on apartment buildings on the Upper East Side. And on the Upper West Side, two Jewish women were assaulted after calling out individuals who were despicably tearing down posters of Israeli hostages. Last week in Brooklyn, three attackers violently attacked a 15-year-old Jewish boy, yelling Free Palestine as they punched and kicked the stranger. This anti-Semitic hate is happening across the country. The Oakland City Council rejected a bid to denounce Hamas, as speaker after speaker espoused dangerously misguided and factually erroneous views at a deeply troubling anti-Semitic public hearing. Since the Israel-Hamas war began, the GOP has seemed gleeful at their partisan wedging at the expense of the Jewish community, and they have utterly failed to do anything serious to address this crisis. Let me be unequivocally clear. Most anti-Zionism, particularly in this moment, has a real anti-Semitism problem. But we cannot fairly say that one equals the other. As the most senior Jewish member in this House, with perhaps the largest Jewish constituency in this country, I have always and will always support real, meaningful legislation to combat anti-Semitism. This, of course, is deeply personal for me and for so many of my constituents. Indeed, I take a backseat to no one in this body when it comes to fighting against this scourge. In the aftermath of October 7th, we have a moral obligation to act to protect our own Jewish citizens and our critical ally, Israel. I pray that the GOP majority makes today the day that they stop playing these partisan games and commit themselves to doing the real work to protect Jewish lives. There is not a single minute to spare. I reserve the balance of my time.
So I play that because Goldman took a different position and took a different position from most Democrats. Where would you be on this?
So just a little background. I was raised in France. My mother's Jewish. My entire American family is Jewish. My father was French. And so I have seen the ugly face of anti-Semitism in France and in Europe as a child, as a young adult, and still today, you know, as I stay in touch with my family there. So the definition of anti-Semitism, which includes anti-Zionism or anti-Israeli sentiment, is the right definition, in my opinion. It's the right definition because very frequently anti-Semitism is hidden behind anti-Zionism or anti-Israeli sentiment. But as Representative Nadler said, it is not automatically equal. And that bill, that working definition, was never meant to be a law. It's meant to be a guideline, which is what it is and what it should have remained at. As unfortunately, the Republicans are playing games with us, same games that Netanyahu is playing, you know, trying to divide us. And we shouldn't have gone along with that. So I would vote it against it. I do think that definition is a very useful definition. I think it's the right definition. But again, as I recall very clearly from a student colleague of mine in college, he was African-American. He'd say, listen, when something happens to me, I don't know if it's because I'm Black or if it's because, you know, I didn't behave correctly. And I think it's often the same with anti-Zionism or anti-Israeli feelings. One, but it doesn't mean it's equal. We have to try to decode it, understand it. So I would not have voted for a law that criminalizes anti-Israeli, you know, saying that Zionism is racism.
All right. I have 2 minutes left, 3 minutes left. How do people get in touch with your campaign? Because now you're in the primary is June 25th, which is about 5 weeks from now on a Tuesday. How do people get in touch with you?
I'm glad you said that because, you know, my campaign manager has a clock with the number of days to the election. So the pressure keeps on growing every day. So we have a website and Instagram, Bruno, B-R-U-N-O, number 4. In, you know, the letter, the number, congress.com. So Bruno4congress.com. I'd love to, you know, respond to messages. I'd love to be invited to any events to talk. We accept any, you know, small donations at this point, because we are building an organization. We have, you know, campaign manager and so on. And yeah, I'm looking forward to more interactions. But I'd love to finish on just saying that this walk has shown me that we have an amazing city and an amazing district. I mean, the district, this 10th district is, has some of the most amazing neighborhoods in New York. And I mean, I'm in love with the city. It's an extraordinary city. I found that a lot of people here love the city. There's a diversity, which is incredible. You know, nine neighborhoods in Brooklyn in the district, 9 or 10, depending on how you classify Alphabet City in Manhattan, you know, lower Manhattan. And they're each different and wonderful in their own ways. And so when I talk about there's a need for housing, we need to have a really clear housing plan. We shouldn't be just cutting corners and destroying old stuff and just putting, we need to have a really clear long-term plan like many cities around the world. And I know Paris very well, and thank God they didn't fall for that. But we have this incredible opportunity to keep on making the city absolutely fantastic. So I'm very optimistic. There's so much we can do. It's same on climate. You know, there's some clear risks. If we don't do anything, we're in real trouble. But there are things we can do. It's in our power. We can solve our political craziness. We can, you know, open primaries, ranked choice voting. There are things we can do. That's what I've done my entire life. Try to resolve problems by getting smart people around the table who have different opinions and coming up with pragmatic solutions.
Thank you so much, Bruno. And we'll check in with you as we get closer to primary day. Good luck.
And thank you, Arthur. Thank you, everyone.
All right. So we're going to next play a piece that was on Democracy Now! This morning, I believe, about an encampment at the University of Michigan that was broken up, I guess, yesterday by the police. And I just want to add some comment about that after we hear this this clip. And it's in the context of people trying to please or show that they're not anti-Semitic, and university administrators trying to show they're not anti-Semitic. But let's look at this clip from Democracy Now! This morning.
We now look at the ongoing crackdown on student-led protests in solidarity with Palestine across U.S. college campuses. An encampment at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor is the latest to be violently dismantled by police. And President Santa Ono claimed the peaceful action had become a threat to public safety. Dozens of officers dressed in riot gear, wielding batons, raided the encampment before dawn Tuesday, pepper spraying and pushing students to the ground as they tore down the camp. At least 4 people were arrested Tuesday, while 2 others were hospitalized after being pepper sprayed by police. Student protesters set up the encampment about a month ago, demanding the University of Michigan's endowment divest from companies with ties to Israel. This comes as the school's president, Santa Ono, is slated to appear before Congress tomorrow, alongside the presidents of UCLA and Yale, to testify about their responses to the student-led protests and how they're addressing reports of anti-Semitism on campus. For more, we're joined by Salma Hamami, Palestinian-American student at the University of Michigan, who just graduated earlier this month. Salma is the president of Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at the University of Michigan. On Tuesday morning, she was pepper sprayed and beaten by police who raided the university pro-Palestine encampment. Joining us from Southfield, Michigan. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Salma. Can you describe what happened yesterday? And just to be clear, this has all happened after graduation at Mish?
Hi. Yes, it did all happen after graduation. Students at the encampment have been holding down the encampment long after, even after graduation. And at approximately 5:40 a.m., police came in full riot gear, actually while we were having a church service on the Diag, moving them out and essentially giving us a 10-minute warning saying that we must be cleared off of the encampment. However, that 10 minutes surprisingly turned into 5 minutes, and they immediately began to charge at the protesters and at the students with their batons and pepper spray. Nearly every step forward that they took, chemicals were being sprayed in every direction. As students were falling to the floor in agony and in pain, they continued to push forward, beating students with batons. And us standing, we were trying to, you know, hold up on to the students who have fallen down and lift them and take them over to safety. Yet they even began to arrest students in that very moment. So it was very difficult to keep track of who was being arrested because, you know, we unfortunately could not see in those moments due to the chemical attacks directly sprayed onto our eyes. And they constantly pushed us further and further back. It took them about half an hour to entirely remove us from the encampment as we tried our absolute hardest to remain strong and remain standing at the encampment. However, as we were pushed further and further back, students, unfortunately, were unable to remain standing due to the pepper spray and due to the intense beating with the batons as well. Students' phones were even confiscated as we were recording them. I personally, myself, was holding a megaphone and kept a reasonable distance from the cops as well as I was chanting, specifically emphasizing why I was there and why I was protesting at the encampment. I repeatedly said that my family has been killed and that is why I am here. And as I was saying that through the megaphone, police officers snatched the megaphone out from my hand and threw it behind them. So not only was it an attack on the encampment, but it was an attack on us as students protesting entirely. And it was quite a traumatic experience, to say the least, but unfortunately not one that was surprising at all, given the response that the university has taken against student protesters within the last 8 months. This is not the first time that the university has unleashed violent police against students. And currently, as you mentioned, four are now facing felony charges. Three were actually hospitalized. And, you know, due to the inhaling of the pepper spray, several of us are unable to properly breathe at the moment due to the tactics that they deployed.
The reason I play that, besides that it is one more example of what I consider to be unnecessary violence by administrators of various universities, I have to say this as a Columbia veteran of building occupations, blockades. I found an old article that I was named in a temporary restraining order. Efforts by Columbia to kick me out of school. I've been there. I understand it. And here and there we had the police and they cleared buildings, et cetera, et cetera. But there wasn't the level of violence that there is going on today on some of the campuses begun by the idiots that are running Columbia. Some of this seems to flow as we just heard, the administrator, the president of Michigan is going to testify in front of Congress tomorrow about efforts on the part of that university to fight anti-Semitism. And the Columbia president, the Columbia, whatever her title was, who decided to do to clear the encampments and have the police come onto Columbia the first time, which is what launched all the nationwide reaction, occurred. She made that decision about an hour after testifying in front of the Republican House Oversight Committee about efforts at Columbia to prove to those Republican anti-Semites, frankly, most of them, who probably wouldn't sit next to a Jew if they could avoid it, to prove to them that she wasn't anti-Semitic. So she literally left reading the backstory of that. She left the hearing. She went to the meet with her lawyers at Covington and Burling, who had helped her prep for the hearing, and they made a decision there to clear the encampment, an encampment which 2 days before there had been half the people in the encampment had had a Seder on Passover. The need for university administrators all over the country to show that they were clearing these encampments and doing it in a way that I think students who do that are willing to accept. I was, when I was a student, that I might get arrested. They're willing to accept that they might get into trouble at school. But then the level of police violence that we have seen all over the country, which has been, and maybe next week we'll get into this on a, there's been a report at UCLA where there was allegedly pro-Israel demonstrators attacking people in the encampment at UCLA. It's turned out that those pro-Israel attackers turned out to be organized by the Proud Boys and others of that ilk, led by various anti-Semites who were trying to make pro-Israel folks look violent and bad. So, you know, I want to talk about that more on my show next week, or maybe the week after, because I'm hoping next week to have some special programming about disability rights in New York City. And with that being said, with the hope I try to end every show with, we're going to hear Jennifer Hudson sing Change Is Gonna Come. I'll see everybody next Wednesday.
I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the headlines. After a night of intense bombardment, Israeli tanks advanced deeper into the heart of Rafah on Wednesday. The attacks killed 62 Palestinians, even as residents of the enclave cheer the governments of Ireland, Spain, and Norway, who announced Wednesday they would recognize Palestine as an independent state. The United States says it has warned Israel about a major invasion of the enclave, where more than a million Palestinians have sought refuge. In Washington, the White House said the attacks fall beneath the red line for a major invasion, though, because they were targeted and limited. Meanwhile, the leaders of Norway, Ireland, and Spain said their countries will formally recognize Palestine as an independent nation next week. Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris.
Last month, I stood on these same steps with Prime Minister Sanchez of Spain, and we said that the point of recognizing the state of Palestine was coming closer. That point has now arrived. Today, Ireland, Norway, and Spain are announcing that we recognize the state of Palestine.
Harris added, it's only the beginning.
And I'm confident that further countries will join us in taking this important step in the coming weeks.
Harris spoke of the long and continuing struggle by Ireland for independence from Great Britain as an inspiration.
We believe in freedom and justice as the fundamental principles of international law, and because we believe that permanent peace can only be secured upon the basis of the free will of a free people.
A member of the Parliament for the Nationalist Party, Sinn Féin, is Mary Lou MacDonald.
Israel's attacks on Gaza are war crimes. Ireland can and must take an active role within the international community in pushing for an immediate and full ceasefire and to hold Israel to account.
Norway's Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre said a two-state solution was in Israel's best interest, while Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez made a similar statement to cheering members of the parliament in Madrid. Most of the world has long recognized Palestine as a state, but on Wednesday, European nations joined the rest for the first time, leaving the United States, Canada, Australia, France, Germany, Britain, Italy, and a few other smaller countries as the last holdouts. And the Palestinian Prime Minister Riyad Mansour hailed the recognition of the three states and said, there's no turning back.
We will continue the pressure, all of us, until the last obstacle standing on our way of acquiring our natural and legal right for admission to become a reality. I can see it as I see you in front of me. It's only a matter of time.
Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz said the decision would carry severe consequences and ordered the immediate return of the Israeli ambassadors from the three countries for consultations. The recognition of Palestine comes a day after the International Criminal Court brought charges of war crimes against three leaders of Hamas and Israel's defense minister and prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who accused ICC prosecutor Karim Khan of anti-Semitism.
Through this incendiary